This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell. In the studio with me is David Herlihy. He is the author of The Lost Cyclist, the epic tale of an American adventure and his mysterious disappearance. It is quite an adventurous tale of a fellow named Frank Lenz who went on a round-the-world trip on his bicycle back in the 1890s. David, welcome to the WVXU WMUB studios.
Pleasure to be here, Mark.
Well, let's set the scene. I know you've done a lot of work on bicycle history, but set the scene in the late 1800s about where the bicycle was, because right before Frank Lenz made his trip, the bicycle that was all in vogue is those ones we see in the old photos with the big, big, big front wheel.
That's right, the high wheeler. The late 1880s when Frank starts cycling is really a transition period in cycling. You see the first safety bikes, the diminutive kind of modern prototypes being imported from England around that time. And, you know, at first some old-time riders like Frank didn't think they would achieve much of a demand, but in fact they did. And by the time he starts his world tour in 92, the high wheeler's already obsolete.
Now, he was a high wheeler beforehand. He was a cyclist from a young age, what, 17, I think?
He was a teenager, probably, I think, about 19 when he bought his first wheel, the high wheeler. And I doubt that he wanted to give it up. I think he would have preferred to go around the world on that if he had a choice, but no sponsor was going to pay him to ride an obsolete wheel.
Well, it seems that that was mainly a sport for men at the time. Describe trying to ride a high wheeler, because I just can't imagine. I guess I'm spoiled on the modern bicycle, but I can't imagine trying to hop up on one of those.
You definitely had to learn a technique to roll it along, and then there was a little footrest off the backbone, so you'd have to put one foot on that and kind of vault yourself while you're pushing it along onto the saddle. And then you had to do kind of a similar process in reverse when you stopped. So that was a little tricky. People say once you're on one of those things, it's pretty stable. But, you know, unless, of course, you hit something on the road and then you fly over the handlebars and you have what's called a header.
And that's a long way down, too.
It was. Well, that's, of course, why the safety was called the safety, because you didn't fall as far.
Well, the safety, describe what the safety bicycle is. It is basically what we know as a bicycle today, correct?
It is, and it was, the key innovations were the chain and sprocket drive, which allowed, you could replicate the same gear ratio you had on a high wheeler with a much smaller and more inviting profile. That was what kind of initially appealed about the safety, and it's when women really started to ride as well. What really clinched its triumph over the high wheeler was the introduction of the pneumatic tire. You know, clearly inflatable tires weren't well suited for the old high wheelers with that enormous front wheel. And when it was clear that the pneumatic was a great advantage, then that really did seal the fate of the high wheeler.
Well, Frank Lenz, let's talk about Frank Lenz. He was an accountant, quit his job to go on this round-the-world bicycling trip. But he had done quite a bit of adventuring beforehand just around his home base there in Pennsylvania.
That's true. Well, he was a passionate cyclist. When he bought his high wheeler, he racked up about 2,000 miles a year, which if you think of the unpaved roads and the hilly terrain around Pittsburgh was pretty good. In fact, it was tops in the region. And he did, because he had this dream of getting a sponsor to go around the world, he did several kind of warm-up trips, if you will, the kind of long-distance rides with his best buddy Charles Petticord. That was sort of intended to build his portfolio as a cyclist and a photographer. So one summer vacation, he went to St. Louis in 1890, and then the next year, he went to New Orleans.
So on his round-the-world trip, he did find a sponsor in Outing Magazine, mm-hmm. who backed him up, provided some equipment. But what was so special about his round-the-world trip? Because it had already been done by an Englishman, if I recall.
Yes, an English-born American, I guess to be more precise, Thomas Stevens, who was really Frank's idol. He had completed a round-the-world trip on his high-wheeler in 1886, so about the time that Frank took up cycling. But he had only done about 14,000 miles over three continents in 3 years, and Frank was aiming to accomplish 20,000 miles in 2 years if he could.
And he's also writing East to West for the first time and carrying a camera, which is part of what he pitched
exactly.
to get a sponsor, correct?
Right. In fact, that really, I think that probably was what the only way he got the deal was because Stevens had not carried a camera, which, of course, in those days were pretty bulky affairs. So Frank's angle really was that he would not only top Stevens, but more importantly, he would photograph the scenery and not just, he wouldn't just have some artist imagining the scene. So that was definitely, I think, a big plus in his package.
Now, that lightweight camera he carried around from Coke, that what weighed 20 pounds, I think,
at
something
least,
like that.
Yeah, a big boxy wooden affair. And thank goodness he had switched just before the trip from glass plates, which is how he started, to film, which had just been introduced. So that did lighten the load somewhat. And he could have bought one of the early Kodaks, but he thought that they were kind of a toy and he prided himself on his professional photography.
I'm speaking with David Herlihy. He's the author of The Lost Cyclist, the epic tale of an American adventure and his mysterious disappearance. A new book in bookstores right now, The Story of Frank Lenz. So Frank launches on to this round-the-world trip and begins here in the United States, travels up through Canada, then goes across the West and seems to be having the time of his life. Everything seems to go well. Then he sails to Hawaii, then on to Japan, and from all accounts, enjoyed seeing the interesting culture in Japan, but didn't like the food, from what I understand.
He had some issues with, I think it was a little too much fish to his liking.
But then he goes into China, and that's really when his round-the-world trip begins to become a little more arduous. What happened in China?
Well, Frank knew all along that would be the tough part. First of all, there was a very strong anti-foreigner feeling. There had just been a wave of riots, and a number of missionaries had been killed. You know, of course, Frank was a magnet for unwanted attention everywhere he went.
Because the bicycle was a newfangled machine, right?
Well, I think it was partly, that was certainly part of it. I think probably no one had seen one before, no one that he met in China. Of course, just being a Westerner made him odd enough. I mean, they probably hadn't seen Westerners either, so most of the people he ran across. So, there was no way he was going to avoid attention as much as he tried to blend in. And sometimes it turned hostile. There was one incident where he was almost killed by a mob of peasants who, for some reason, had an issue with Lenz.
And the bicycle, they thought they were superstitious, correct?
I think the bike could have been part of that. I think it could very well have scared people. And in fact, so did photography. And Frank was, although he took photos of some of the Chinese people he met, he was always very careful not to let on that he was doing that because he knew there was a superstition against that.
Well, let's talk about his kind of adventures along the road, because the roads weren't really roads. Bicycling wasn't then what it is today in the way of being able to do it. And he ran into some of that in China with the bad roads. And so, I guess to politely put it, he didn't ride the whole way.
No. In fact, he rode very little in China, partly because he was passing through winter, which wasn't the best season, but there were mountains that, of course, he couldn't handle on his own, and he knew that. I mean, he was prepared to walk, but it took him much longer than he had anticipated. I think he was planning on 2 months, and it took him 6. And he would have to hire what he called coolies. Those were young men to help him over the mountainous stretches. They would actually tie the bike onto a pole and carry it on their shoulders, the ends of the poles on their shoulders.
Well, let's talk about the mysterious disappearance part. What happened to Frank Lenz?
Well, he did get through China, which was really quite amazing. And then he had relatively smooth sailing through India and then Persia. And then when he reached the northwest corner of that country, he had sort of a decision to make. He was heading for Europe, but the most direct way was across Turkey. That was about 1,000 miles along the old caravan road to Istanbul. But he had been warned by various missionaries not to take that route because it was notoriously dangerous. There were nomadic Kurds who were known to attack Westerners. There were also reports of Armenian uprisings. So several had advised him to go through Russia, but he turned that advice down, and he did, in fact, head off for Turkey. And it was later, the last photo we have of Frank was in the city of Tabriz just before he reached Turkey. It was confirmed that he entered Turkey, but he apparently didn't get much farther than that. So he was evidently killed about 900 miles from Europe, which would have been very smooth sailing had he gotten there.
This was almost, this was 2 years into his trip, correct? He was going to try to do 2 years, but that slog through China kind of slowed him down a wee bit.
That's right, yeah. And he had a few bouts with malaria, I believe, and other diseases. So, yeah, he had lost time, but he was still feeling pretty good about his chances and probably too good. He might have been a little overconfident at that point when he decided to go through Turkey. At the very least, he should have taken precautions. He probably should have hired a guard on horseback, but he doesn't appear to have done that.
Well, it's equally fascinating story what happened after he disappeared, but I'll leave that for readers of the book to discover. But very, very exciting tale. Why do you think the story of Frank Lenz has been pretty much lost?
I think it's in part because these round-the-world bike trips started to seem quite quaint pretty quickly once motorbikes came along and automobiles. And I think Frank also, it was a general perception that he was a little reckless. So I think at a certain point there was a loss of public sympathy. But a lot of those cyclists from the gay 90s, from the boom, the famous as they were in their period, quickly faded. So it is kind of surprising, though, that the Lenz story, I think, had remained untouched for so long.
David Herlihy, the author of The Lost Cyclist, the epic tale of an American adventurer and his mysterious disappearance, available in bookstores now. You can learn more by visiting our website, wvxu.org. Thank you, David, for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure, Mark. Thank you.